Hello everyone and a warm welcome back to Footprints. This month we're exploring Bath's industrial past and the enormous changes in the landscape that Bath has seen over the decades since many of their factories have disappeared. The Georgians and the Romans are such a strong feature of Bath's architectural landscape that we forget that it's had an illustrious industrial past and possibly, as we'll find out, a present. We'll meet a man who's written a book about Bath's industrial buildings and we'll hear from the council's planning office about some of the things that they need to take into consideration when deciding what can and should be built in this wonderful UNESCO World Heritage City. But to start with, let's meet Peter Dunn, a man who from the age of seven wanted to build cranes. And his wish came true when he started as an apprentice at Stothart & Pitt, the great crane building firm right in the centre of Bath. I met him outside Newark Works, which is just over the river from Green Park and is what the old Stothart & Pitt factory is now called. Of course, I did really want to hear about what it was like to work there, but I was also intrigued to find out more about how he came to restore the crane that's now sitting opposite Newark Works by the river in his back garden. Here he is.
This crane was built in this yard in 1864, we believe. We can't actually date it accurately, so we say circa 1864. But they made this model for another 30 or 40 years. So I found it by overhearing a conversation I was in the Museum of Bath at work one day for some conference. And the curator there was having his ear bent by this lady. And she kept saying, "What are you going to do about my Stothart & Pitt crane?" Well, being as I'm a bit of an anorak with cranes, I dived in, interrupted. And she owned a quarry. Her husband had owned it, and she inherited the quarry and she'd inherited the crane, and she didn't want the crane there, but it was quite, she knew it was old and important. So we went up to Corsham and we looked at it, because there was some worry about it falling down, and there certainly was. A lot of the timbers on it had rotted out, and we developed a plan, a little team of us, to rescue it and restore it. We didn't know where it was going at that time, and the only place I could put it was in my garden.
In your garden you restored this crane, and for listeners, can you just describe it?
It's hand operated, and it would lift 6 tons. To lift 6 tons you really needed 2 people, one each side, on a big crank handle, which are not on there now, we've took them off. And it worked firstly for the Great Western Railway, and then it was moved to a stone quarry. And later, I think in the 80s, the quarry was closing down, and the local doctor in Corsham, actually Box, he bought it for the scrap value and put it in his garden. So it likes back gardens. And when I think it was moving, he wanted it rid of it. And at the time, a guy called David Pollard, a historian, he bought a quarry, a working quarry, because he was really interested in the stone quarries around Box. And he moved it to his quarry, where it stayed until 2017, when we took it out. 18, sorry, when we took it out.
But Peter, yeah. I mean, it's 2 stories high. It was in your back garden. What did the neighbours think?
Well, nobody really complained. And people could see it over the fence. We never put the jib up this high, so it was only as high as this, only this, which is 3 meters at most. Yeah, so that people could see it over the fence, and a lot of people would look over now and again. And we're a bit isolated, so nobody would.
And how did you get it from that guy's garden to your garden?
Right, we got a transport company from Bristol. And I was recommending him. He does a lot of machinery movements. And he came up and he had a crane on the back of his lorry. And we dismantled it with that and him. And he took it to my house. And eventually it was moved the same way to here. And then we had a massive mobile crane that built this. So, yeah.
So, Tell me about Stotham Pit. How long did you work there? When did you start and how old were you?
Right, I was 16 when I started. That was in 1970. And I went into their training school for apprentices for 1 year. And then we moved out into the factory after that. And it was a five-year apprenticeship in those days because they counted 1 year because you stayed on an extra year at school. So that was 1 year of apprenticeship they counted. So and I worked in this yard until we closed this yard in, I think, 1984. And we moved further back into out of Bath a little bit into the Victoria Works where we carried on building cranes and testing them. And in this yard, I was actually on the commission and testing team of cranes for offshore oil rigs and platforms. And that was fascinating. I really enjoyed that. And then I moved from that and worked overseas and around the UK for them, commissioning, testing offshore cranes and others, older ones as well sometimes. So, yeah. And until 1989, when the company was closed and sold on, and took everything out of Bath to Newcastle. And I had to leave then. I had to leave the crane business, which was a shame. Most of my important work in life, I always thought was here. This is the real job. Yes.
And, so tell me about Stotham Pit in those days. What sort of reputation did it have?
It always had a very good reputation for what they made, and but also had a very good reputation for training apprentices. Somebody said to me, it's the best in the West apprenticeships here. And my grandfather worked here, my father worked here, and I found a wife here. She was working in the office, so and that's how. And a lot of people did the same thing, you know, and met their wives in this business, this industry. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. It was what I always wanted to do. Behind us here, where we're stood, is used to be a football pitch, and my school used to take us down to that pitch to play football once a week or so, and you could see all the cranes here. And I kept looking over and thought, oh, that's wonderful. That's where I want to go. But my father was always leaning me towards doing an apprenticeship anyway. So, yeah. But I was like 7 years old when I thought, this is what I want to do.
So what did you do here in terms of building the cranes? What was your job?
My job here was as a fitter, mechanical fitter. So we actually put everything together in this yard. And we could do bits and pieces of cranes. And sometimes we built the whole thing as well in the yard and test it. And all the offshore cranes were tested here as well. And that was a nice job. Then when I went overseas for them, I was what we call a commissioning and service engineer. Very grand title. And you met all sorts of people from other companies then. Very nice, yeah.
So, I mean, when we look at cranes, sort of general public, we see them on building sites. We see them towering over building sites, particularly tower blocks and things. Have you ever been up to the top of one?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What's that like?
We built tower cranes. And I don't think we never built one in this yard, but we built one in the Victoria yard. And they were a bit wobbly. Mm. A bit more wobbly than the dockside cranes. A much more stable dockside cranes. Tower cranes always sort of bow a bit in the wind. Because if you look at them, very thin structures, really, aren't they? And they've got to be in a small to get in a space and then be able to take it out of that space. So, yeah, they are a bit odd.
How many people worked for Stotham Pit back in the day?
When I started, there was something like 2,000 people working here still. You also got a London office and a London squad of erectors and fitters and that. So they were. And when it closed, there were still 450 people working here. So it's still quite a lot number of people lost their job at that time. Yeah, and
obviously it's changed now. It's no longer Stotham Pit. There's a cafe over there. There's your beautiful restored 6-ton hand-operated crane here. And the factory's been changed into offices. What do you think about that?
Well, at least it's the external building there is the 1852 building. But Stotham Pit started in the middle of Bath, and they were ironmongers more than engineers. And Mr. Stothert, George, came up from south coast, Devon somewhere, and he was a ironmonger. And he started working for a Bath ironmongery firm and eventually took it over. And then his sons joined, and then you have various partners, and eventually became the Stother and Pitt name that everyone knows now, really. Yeah. This was actually designed by a very famous architect as well. His name was Thomas Fuller. And having done this, he then went to Canada and he built the Canadian Parliament buildings and every post office in Canada. He's very famous, and the Fuller Company is still in Canada. And a couple of years ago, I was quite privileged to meet here where we're stood, a relative of him. So that was rather nice, yeah. But this was a, there was a foundry. This is called Foundry Lane now. And the foundry was behind us. This was machine shops, and then in my day, stores. In my day, the machine shops have been moved to the Victoria Works, and this was all fitting shops here. And it's a very nice building, really, and quite interesting inside. It's all converted to modern units, so therefore a lot of the things I looked at in there all disappeared behind panels and things. So.
This facade here of Newark Works, that's how you remember it?
More or less. It hasn't changed much. There was a doorway there, and I've got a picture of a crane being tested just here where we're stood, and you can look through, and there's an old Foden steam lorry stood in that doorway being loaded. And that was 100 years ago. 102 now, yeah.
Did Stother and Pitt build the steam cranes that are in the Harbourside in Bristol?
Yes, there's one steam crane there, what they call the Fairbrain crane, and that was Stother and Pitt, 1880, 1890. Still working, still lifting its original load. And there are four dockside cranes there. They're all electric. They're 1953. So plenty of Stother and Pitt cranes all around the world. And one time, you say, if you were in a ship and it pulled up in a harbour, you'd see the name Stother and Pitt Bath. A lot of servicemen always felt, there's a little bit of home there.
Can you recognise a Stother and Pitt crane from a distance?
Yes, I can very much, very easily, actually. There's some distinctive things about it, and I'm pretty good at that. I'm a crane spotter, if you like. Crane anorak, yeah.
Crane spotter. Well, yeah. You're the first crane spotter I've met.
Well, there are others. more modern.
But Stother and Pitt wasn't the only engineering firm in Bath. Tell me about what else was around when you were here.
Bath, being the Georgian city, it needed services to build the Georgian buildings. So you had stonemasons, and that's where the quarrying industry around Bath came from. And then you needed ironmongery, and there are ovens in the Royal Crescent made by Stothert in their kitchens, still there. Yeah. So they were supplying all that things. There a couple of bridges in Wickham were supplied by Stothert. Some others were brought down from Coburgdale. And, of course, at one time, Stothert's were agents for Coburgdale material. But there are just a lot of engineering. It's the hidden history of Bath. It's not all Georgian. It's not all Roman. There's this sort of industrial archaeology or industrial history of Bath. Very little left now of engineers. I looked up yesterday what there was left, and there's one called Rotorque. They are out on the Loxwood Road. They make all sorts of valves, and I was amazed when I looked at their website what they do make now. Very electronics. And what's the other one? Oh, there's a very famous one called Cross Engineering. Cross is started in the 1930s, but it was I've forgotten the name of the Mr. Cross. He was from Bristol, and he'd worked in the early aircraft industry, building aircraft engines. And he came to Bath, and he started building engines. He built all sorts of engines and development on engines as well. And eventually they thought to themselves that, if we just carry on building engines like this, somebody's going to snap us up. We'll be in amongst Austin or someone like that, or Bedford, all the old people, car manufacturers we had. So they thought, what are we actually good at? And they were good at making piston rings, and they ground them. And so they said, right, we've got to concentrate on what we do best. It's not engines, but that's interesting, that's what we love, but we will make parts. And that's what they did. And it's still a family firm. and they have a big place up at Devizes, and they're making sales virtually for every car comes out of Japan and that. But they've still got a base in Bath.
So the landscape's changed, Peter. It doesn't look quite the same along the waterfront now. What do you think of it?
Well, I'd like to see more cranes, but there is another one further off, a steam crane, actually. It's like 1902, so it's fairly modern compared to this one. Yeah, it's changed. The river changed a lot because of flood protection in the 60s, and you ended up with a lot of horrible concrete piling. There's some behind us. A new bridge built there, which is okay. It's still an interesting river. You can walk up and down it, or you go, if you've got a boat, and cruise up and down it. But Bath has changed. The university changed it an awful lot because people don't work here like they used to so much. But one time, if you walked into the town on Saturday afternoon, those that weren't playing rugby or football, you'd see lots of people you knew and worked with. And all around the suburbs of, like, Oldfield Park, there were people you knew where they lived, and you'd see them in the local shops all the time. And you go into Bath now, I don't see anyone I know. That's the difference, yeah, yeah.
Now, your back garden no longer has that crane in it. What's it got instead? What's your latest project?
It's got a smaller crane in it. And it's a re-restoration, that one. I overhauled it some years ago for the Inland Waterways Association. And I've also got a Stotherton Pit road roller, and I'll be able to row my lawn with that. Some people know them as cricket pitch rollers, because that's where when they were retired, they became cricket pitch rollers. But they're actually for asphalt on the road and that.
Thank you so much, Peter, for coming out here today and talking to me and bringing back to life Stotherton Pit.
hope I did. Yeah, there's lots more stories you could probably tell about this place and a lot of people. And I see it as it was a privilege to me to bring a crane back. And it's there in memory of the thousands and thousands of people who would have worked here in this yard since sort of 1852. So, yeah, it's a tribute to all the skills we had here is now lost. But, yeah.
Thank you. Oh, thanks so much to Peter Dunn there. Now, let's go a bit downstream to the little building opposite the Loxbrook campus of Bath Spa University. Here I met up with Paul Fisher, who's written a book called Walks to Works, 5 walks detailing encyclopedial knowledge of Bath's industrial past. He wanted to tell me about Bath's furniture making companies, and I started by asking him why he wanted to show me the little building.
It was a furniture factory. It's architecturally interesting as a really rather wonderful modernist building. One of the best buildings that's been built in Bath since the war. Not the sort of normal Georgian pastiche. This is a modern building. Anybody can come and visit it. You can go inside. It's Lidl now. The half of it that we're looking at on the right is, and on the left there's other shops there. From the car park where we're standing, we can see what are called the space frame technology, which allows for a completely open space with inside, about 60,000 square feet, which would be configured any way that anyone manufacturing stuff, or indeed as a retailing premises, it's a very flexible building. And it uses a German technology called the Mero space frame. It was the first building to use it in Britain, put up in the mid-60s. It was put up for a firm called Bath Cabinet Makers, and they belong to a Bath furniture making tradition that goes back into the 18th century, really. The big houses here needed posh furniture to match, and at first it was individual craftsmen, and then they cohered into factories, first small and then larger. And now, in fact, there's still, I think, number of bespoke carpenters in Bath is as high as anywhere. But they work from individual premises and on site. So in a way, going back to 18th century ways. Bath Cabinet Makers was founded in the mid-1890s after there'd been a strike in the Albion furniture factory on the Upper Bristol Road. And the organiser of it got the sack. They then formed a cooperative. It reverted to a more traditional mode of operation. And the man, the instigator of the whole project, Charles Richter, became a conventional managing director. But he was a socialist. His firms gave good long holidays. The pay was good. I mean, the pay for skilled craftsmen was good in Bath. And there was a great emphasis on education and people very proud to work at Bath Cabinet Makers. He was a modernist. He was no admirer of William Morris, for example. He said that you could machine good furniture. You could do it with high-quality material, high-quality machines, and needed a lot of skill. You could turn out a lot of product, and it would make a profit. As the firm developed, it found quite a non-socialist market, sold through Harrods and Maples in London. They supplied the Cunard liners. They moved on later after the war as one of the main designers for the utility furniture. Do you remember that? It was a bit of state-controlled economy. The state determined what the furniture was and set the standards, and they were very high standards. There were, in fact, three Bath Cabinet Maker factories altogether, and one just off to the right of us where the storage unit, Storage King it's called now, is. That was a four-storey, sort of many-windowed building put up in 1918. Burnt down, some say with arson, in mid-60s. Shame it wasn't saved, because it could have converted into flats or offices very well. I must say a little bit more about Charles Rixer, because he, like many of Bath's industrialists, was born somewhere else. Fairly well off, ambitious, unironic about trade and business and making money. And so there's a whole line of them. We talked about Stothart and Pitts. I mean, the original Stothart came from Dorset, I believe. Yes. Goes right up to James Dyson. Born in Norfolk, still got his home near Bath. He worked for a company along the river called Rotork, an engineering company. Part of what my book is about is how there is still an engineering tradition in Bath. If you just run along the river, you've got British Maritime Technologies, which makes warships and designs warships. You've got, right out the other end, you've got Rotork, which makes high-specification valves all over the world. Incredibly rich company. I think it's a $750 million turnover. People don't know about it. That's in Loxbrook. Very much a Bath story. Started by Jeremy Fry, he of the Fry's Chocolate Factory. He took Dyson on, in fact, and Dyson cut his teeth there, learning about international markets and making much more money than his boss ever did. So there is an engineering tradition in Bath. The furniture making is a kind of adjunct of that. It's more of a craft skill, although it went over to manufacturing. And then Herman Miller, an office equipment, high-end office equipment manufacturer, who, I mean, they made stuff for offices fashionable before Apple got into it. And we now have a fashionable shop in front of us. And it will go on. It has a listing. This building will stay here. It's quite an easy one to maintain. And it's a wonderful thing. Look inside. Just a wonderful kind of range of symmetry disappearing off in perspective down the building. It's lovely. It's nicer than a shop need be, nicer than a factory need be. Now, obviously, little being a shop, you can go to it most times of the day or the evening. In the entrance area, there's an old photograph taken in the 60s, well, just after it was built. And you can see in the background where the furniture storage place is now, the factory that was built in 1918 and came down in 1960.
So it must have looked ultra-modern when it first went up.
This one looked incredibly modern. Yeah, it still does.
Well, look, I think we should walk across the river and see what we can find on the other side, sort of peeking through the trees.
Yeah, good.
OK, so walking from the corner of the little car park over the footbridge.
It's one of two bridges, which are called the Ha'penny Bridges. It used to cost you half a pee to cross it.
Well, we're crossing the Avon. A lot of boats. Here we are looking at another very modernist building.
The architect was Brian Henderson, who designed the Eden Centre, the Channel Tunnel Terminal in Waterloo. And Herman Miller was a fashionable company. They took on a fashionable architect to make themselves a fashionable building. This again is 60s, it doesn't look like it. It's been reclad by the new tenants, who are Bath Spa University Design Department, and is a fantastic place for them to work. The cladding suggests Bath stone, and mirrored glass as well. And inside, it's all the original stuff. Hello, can we come in and have a coffee?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. We're now inside the Loxbrook campus, Bath Spa University Art and Design College.
So it's teaching people trades here as well, which is appropriate. Herman Miller made fashionable office furniture. Charles and Ray Eames were one of their designers, and they worked to the sort of standards that you see in this building. They weren't here for that long because they were so successful over there, they moved to a larger factory in Trippenham and then moved on again.
They're getting ready for the degree show. This is what all the noise is about.
Yeah. But I mean, it's proving a huge success. The students like it here. You know, everybody says wonderful things about this building. It got prizes when it came up. It's a beautifully spacious building, which has retained a lot of its original features. All the yellow steelwork that you see across the top, many of the wood panellings and the actual central atrium is.
The yellow steels are beautiful in here, aren't they? They give such a warm, sort of warm light to the building.
They do, and it has not been adapted at all there. I think the lighting is actually new, the lighting that's been hung. But they kept the feel of this building. And so it was an open plan building for open plan offices. And it's become an open plan-ish kind of educational institution as well.
So here we are here. So just tell us about what Bath looked like along the riverside when this building went up. Was it very different to what it is now?
Well, the Stotherton Pit Factory was there, which extended from the Churchill Bridge right into what's now the new estate down by the gasworks. The river traffic had stopped by then, but it was busy. It was smoky. It was noisy. You'd have heard the railway ends were just going as this building came up. There were thousands employed down here, 3,000 at Stotherton Pit. And I don't know the numbers here, but for both these factories, a lot of people worked here. A lot of people work for Herman Miller and a lot of people work for Bath Cabinet Makers as well. But it still is a place of employment. I mean, going down the river, you've got the British Marine Technology in the buildings near Churchill Bridge. You've got the Stotherton Pit Bridge works, which have been revived, so there's all sorts of software and design stuff going on there. As you come down here, next to this building is Horsemen. They used to make cars. They've made tank components since the middle of the 20s. One of these very discreet companies that makes a fortune out of military technology. They have a patent on, or they had a patent in the mid-20s, which was to prevent tanks from recoiling too much when they'd fired, so their guns didn't flap up and down for 5 minutes. That technology is still being used. So you have that there. You also have Rotork at the end. So there's still manufacturing going on here. There's still an engineering tradition carried on at the university as well. And of course, the other one I didn't mention is Borough Happold. Another man who came from out of town, I think Happold was from Leeds. He was working for Ove Arup and he wanted to work from home. They said no, so he set up his own business. It's a design engineering firm. So, my favourite building, there's the Tottenham Hotspur Football Stadium. Yeah.
You're a Spurs fan.
Yeah. Well, I'm an Arsenal fan, actually, but I like football stadia as well. And it's a much more impressive football stadium than Arsenal's is not got a touch on the Spurs stadium.
Paul, just tell me about your book. It's called Walks to Works 2, which suggests there's a Walks to Works 1.
There is indeed. There's a Bristol version as well, which was a lockdown project, which I did with my wife, a COVID project. And then we did this one.
Tell me what the five walks are.
Let's have a look. I'll show you here. Right. The first one travels along the old Somerset-Dorset railway line from Widcombe. And then goes as far as Loxbrook and the Rotork factory, and then back along the river, including these two furniture factories, and then through to Stotherton Pier, which is in fact at the beginning of the second walk, which goes up through Broad Quay, which is that was the main port area of Bath and into the city, and where you can see a lot of very, very locally based industrial stuff. Cities used to have people working in them and making. You go up Milsom Street, the basements and the top floors of those places, they were quite often making what they were selling in the shops. Harnesses and clothes and framing pictures and binding books. Those things were, that, and Bath was no different to any other town like that. So that's the second walk. The third walk goes along the canal, talks about the canal and the railways, then goes up to the university and back into town. The final one goes south, the final one in Bath goes south, and takes in all the quarrying the fantastic de Montalt mill, where they made high quality paper, down to the old Somerset and Dorset Canal, along where William Smith proved to himself his theories about geology and strata and the shape of the land, and then back up to the top and down. That's my favourite. And it's a good way of getting to learn Bath. I learnt a huge amount of Bath doing it. The final walk is in Bradford-on-Avon, which was the centre of molten rubber. And Bradford was a full-on industrial town. You asked early on what was it like here in the 60s in Bath. It wasn't nearly as industrialised as Bradford. Bradford was a rubber town. Filthy place. Noisy. Smelly. That has changed very much. I think the effect of redevelopment along the river has been to open it up. I mean, port areas used to be very much demarcated, and factories are. They have valuable stuff in them. So they have high fences and locked doors. You can't walk through factory areas generally. And the local authority, in opening up the river to the west, it's done a wonderful job. It's made this town face into the river at this end of town. But as for the landscape here, I think people would have found it unimaginably dirty and smelly. The further you went back in time, the smellier it would have got. So the smell of putrefaction in the churches until legislation was passed in the middle of the 19th century. People must have tolerated unbelievably bad smells. So that's not landscape, that's hygiene. But it would have seemed very, very dirty. And the buildings have been cleaned up now. The image has been cleaned up. And now we talk about the tourism industry, which isn't really an industry at all. It doesn't make anything. It makes money for people and is an incredibly important part of the economy here, as is the student place, which takes us back to here. So another way that the landscape has changed is that all down the Lower Bristol Road are the blocks of student accommodation, which will be repurposed soon enough, I would think, into council housing. Because the students aren't going to keep coming here. We're discouraging that already. Oh, of course, the other thing, Bath and every other city, every other English city, every other European city would have had chimney stacks everywhere, bellowing their smoke out. Bath is an oddity because most towns in the Northern Hemisphere have their factory and industrial and high-density areas to the east of town. So the prevailing winds take away their smell away from the posh, yeah? Not in Bath, because the river was the main route in and the industry developed from Twerton with wool making in the Middle Ages, which was as far upriver as they could get, and the land was cheaper than in town for them to build the big factories and do it on a large scale in the 19th century. Again, I mean, think of the people that lived up in the Royal Crescent. They looked straight down onto this ramshackle factory. They were looking down into acres of corrugated iron and railway sidings and smoke and chimneys. So perhaps Bath was a more kind of integrated place then.
That was absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much to Paul Fisher, and details of his book are in the show notes. Don't forget, you can go on his walk during Bathscape's Walking Festival in September. Next up is Steve George. Now, he is the principal planner in the planning policy team for Bath and North East Somerset Council. His team look at what they would like to see developed in Bath in the future, based on clear evidence of what's needed. In the context of a UNESCO World Heritage Site, their job is to balance the competing needs for affordable residential housing, student accommodation, office space for a range of businesses from startups to large established companies, industrial units, while taking into account the design needs of a heritage-rich environment, and at times also safeguarding some land from being developed at all. In this episode, we're thinking about particularly the riverside landscape and how that's changed in the last century or so, because it was very industrial, very smoky, very dirty. It's very different these days. Tell me a little bit about some of the newest developments that have come up along there, and then we'll think about what you take into consideration when granting those planning applications.
So a lot of the new developments that we've been doing have actually been residential-led, developments. And if we look at, say, the Bath Western Riverside development, that started coming on stream in about 2008, I think. But that was a long, long process of actually trying to regenerate that site. It had been empty for a long, long time. I think it was bought by Robert Maxwell, who just sat on it for a long time. And actually, it just goes to demonstrate that it's a long, old process to bring them forward for development. And what we try to do, and we enable that development to come forward in a way that protects the valued assets that we have as a World Heritage Site. So our key issues will always be building heights and the design of buildings as well, in terms of how they respond to the landscape and how they respond to views. It's always a bit of a sort of negotiation, I suppose. I suppose we seek to manage change in the city.
I'm just thinking about the difference between Bath and Bristol. There's a lot of high-density building in Bristol. There's a lot of buildings that are sort of rising up higher and higher. And you talked about having a roof line here that's much lower than Bristol.
Yeah.
How does that affect developers? I mean, presumably they don't get as much bang for their buck.
Obviously, it's a really sensitive site. It's a World Heritage Site. It's a double inscribed World Heritage Site. We commissioned a building heights strategy in about 2010, and that's been a really important part of the evidence base that we've used in setting the planning policy framework, but also in negotiating with developers coming forward. It's a key characteristic of the city that buildings need to respond to the context and character of the place. So Bristol's different, and it has a different character, and it has a different context. And I wouldn't want to see buildings of that scale in the city, because I think they would damage the values of the World Heritage Site, the outstanding universal values of the World Heritage Site. And I think what's really important, or one important distinction about both Bath and Bristol, I think we work well together and always have done. And I think actually Bath is a place that attracts talented people, and those talented people are often the ones that will set up new businesses. And we have a whole range of businesses that we still have the legacy from. So companies like Horseman or Rotork were set up within the city. Companies like Future Publishing or Borough Happold, Grant Associates, Field and Clegg Bradley. So all of these companies were small companies that started in the city and grew to be global businesses. I think it's a really important role of the city, and it's part of the value of its global reputation, I think, and its beauty is that it attracts talented people. And those talented people do create these businesses that will grow, and they will hopefully stay in Bath, but sometimes they will move on because they've become so successful and they need to find more floor space, or perhaps most of their staff live in Bristol. And so there is a relationship between Bath and Bristol. I think it's a complementary relationship, and I think we're stronger together.
There's land, presumably, all over the place that's bought up by developers, by supermarkets, by companies for possible future use that they're not developing. And you alluded to this with Robert Maxwell. So is that a problem around here? Is that a problem nationally? Do we have a lot of land that is undeveloped that nobody can persuade the owners to develop?
Yeah, we do have this. And it's a common occurrence nationally. So you do have land that is bought by certain companies or individuals that will want to see certain things happen on that site, which might be against policy. For example, on the Bath Press site, that was sold to Tesco's. So this was a long time ago. They wanted to put a large supermarket on there. At the time, that was against policy, so there was a big public inquiry against that, and the council were successful, so we won that battle against Tesco's. But what happens with that, it increased the value of that site. So Tesco's bought the site for a particular amount of money, and the ability of someone else to purchase that site is constrained. So it means often sites are kind of mothballed for a long period of time until the economic cycle changes again, and it becomes more attractive economically for someone else to purchase that site. Now, Tesco's is a bit of a separate case because they're looking at the money that goes through the tills rather than the capital cost of it. But the same principle will apply to other sites. for example, the King Edward School site that's owned by someone from Samuel Smith's brewery. So it stood empty for a long period of time. And we haven't been able to secure an active use for that building. And so things like that are quite frustrating in planning. So we don't have control over what happens on sites. We have to respond to planning applications that will come in.
So let's finish with what the ambitions are for Bath in terms of planning policy, new developments, landscape.
So we want new development to meet the needs of a growing city. So the city's changing. And we've got a massive affordable housing problem. And the cost of housing for existing residents or new residents is too much. That's a key priority of the council. In terms of the quality of housing that we want to see, or the quality of development we want to see, there's a great quote from an archaeologist, Barry Cunliffe: the World Heritage Site is not a constraint, but it's an invitation to excel. And I think it's a key asset of Bath is that kind of developers will come in, and we've been quite successful over the past 15 years with the amount of development that we have had in the city. Unfortunately, a lot of that development, though, is kind of higher-end, kind of residential development. There's been a lot of student housing as well, which is needed by the universities, but it isn't necessarily meeting our own kind of residential housing need. But a big task that we've got is trying to facilitate more growth in the economy, so in terms of the office accommodation, but also industrial accommodation. In terms of the production quarter, which is where businesses like Horseman are at the moment, and Rotork. We recently worked with Field and Clegg on the production quarter master plan. So we looked at that whole area in terms of what the opportunities are for intensifying that area in terms of industrial floor space, but also the kind of future economy. What are the future workspaces that could be accommodated in that kind of area? But it's also trying to sell the assets of the area in terms of its relationship to the river, and actually how important that is for the people that are working in those businesses, so they can enjoy the riverside environment. They can cycle in from say the centre of Bath or from further afield. But it's trying to secure that sort of economic fortunes for the city by having a variety of employment spaces in different parts of the city. I think South Keys is a really good example where the council built a new office building of high spec, so it's a grade A spec that will appeal to certain businesses that want to be on one floor in an open plan area. So they're typically sort of mid-sized businesses, I suppose. But we've also, as part of that scheme, so TCN bought the former Newark Works building. And they've created sort of creative workspaces there. So that will appeal to smaller businesses and startup businesses that require smaller spaces, but also more flexible terms. So that's a really good investment within the city of a company like TNT that can really set up to manage or to work with those smaller businesses. And there's been quite a few of those of kind of similar kind of managed workspace businesses that are becoming established in this city. So they're taking over, it could be existing office buildings in terms of a part of the Georgian stock, or it could be, I'd say, 1960s buildings that have been repurposed as kind of flexible workspaces. And that's a really important part of the economy of the city. So it's starting to happen more and more, actually. We're getting actually more vibrant kind of businesses coming into the city. And that's a really important part of how the city functions.
Thank you so much, Steve, for talking to me today and telling me all about the pressures of your department.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope that's helped.
Thanks so much to Steve George there. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you to those who took part in the episode, and you can find links to all the items in the show notes, as usual. Please do email us with any suggestions or comments at info@bathscape.co.uk. We'd really love to hear from you, and don't forget you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. Please share as widely as you can with your friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Bathscape, you can visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.